The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
For the closing prayer. No, I'm just kidding. I wanted to play that song before the message began today because the song that we had heard is a familiar one to most of us. And it's titled, obviously, Onward Christian Soldiers. And their lyrics, they reflect a passionate desire to march against the ungodly and to courageously go to war against that which is evil and to go to war as one body of faith, one in mind, one in purpose. And to put down any foe, understanding that Christ will be with his people. And so the song, it can be very powerful. It can be motivating when it is sung or even when it is just heard, which is why I wanted to play it. There is a kind of romanticism, I think, about the song that is felt internally when the words ring out as we hear them or as they might be sung in harmony. Onward, Christian soldiers, it says. And so this speaks of a battle that believers are involved in, actively involved in today. And it has a theme, I think, that has inspired many, many people. And the song is just an example of this. But the question for us today, or one of the questions, is are we stimulated by this theme of Christianity to go onward as a soldier for Christ? Does the call to fight against the evil in our personal lives motivate us to courageously march, go forward to march against wickedness? Are we inspired, therefore, then to do what is right at all times, no matter what the cost? Do we strive to always keep God's commandments and to work in harmony for the edification of the saints, to preach the gospel united as one body, to help one another, and to support the commission that Christ has given to his people through the church? Let's go over to 1 Peter 5. 1 Peter in chapter 5. In a spiritual sense, I think we would all agree that we are Christian soldiers, and we are fighting a real war. And this war that you and I fight, it has been going on for a long time. It's nothing new. Why, the faces may have changed a bit, the situations might be a little bit different here and there, and they're going to, of course, vary from time to time as generations come and go. But the battles remain the same. They truly do. And the patriarchs fought on the front lines of this conflict, and you and I, we tread the same path. And to begin, I think I would like to point this out as Peter wrote in chapter 5 of his first epistle, and beginning in verse 8, he encouraged Christians to be sober, to be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And then he says, resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings, the same things you and I experience, are experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. And so lions, we're aware, most of us have seen this take action on some of the nature programs. They seek out their prey, and they do so subtly, and they sneak up on them. They try to remain kind of in the background so that their prey doesn't know what's going on. But when the time is right, they pounce. They pounce and they hit them in the right spots, and then they rip their flesh to shreds and devour them. And this type of behavior, as Peter pointed out, is likened to the way Satan works. You see, he is the power behind the iniquity that is found throughout the world, the rebellion against God and his way of life. And he works in ways that are subtle like this as he seeks to attack the prey. And so our fight is not unique in this way. These same types of skirmishes and struggles have been experienced by brothers and sisters around the world today. They will be experienced, and they have been experienced in the past by God's faithful people for thousands of years. Let's go to Exodus chapter 14. Exodus 14. More than 3,000 years ago, the children of Israel found themselves on the front lines of a great war. They knew that God had delivered them out of the slavery in Egypt, and they knew that a monumental part of the battle against lawlessness had passed as they marched, as the scriptures say, in their ranks toward the promised land. But the fight was not over. This was not the end. In many ways, it had just begun. And this had become quite obvious as they stood on the shore of the Red Sea and they had nowhere to go. And they had just come through the canyon there and they were at the Gulf of Aqaba and the Egyptian army had come through. There was no way out. They seemed to be trapped and they were frightened for their lives. And they started crying out to Moses, crying out to God, save us. What's going to happen? They were so fearful. And so, in chapter 13 of Exodus 14, Moses said to the people, do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Eternal, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians who you see today, you shall see again no more forever. And the Eternal will fight for you, he said, and you shall hold your peace. In other words, be quiet. And let's just go forward here. And then he comes right out. God says to Moses, the Lord said, why do you cry to me? Tell the children of Israel to go forward. Go forward. You see, at that time, Israel, during this event, Israel had become blatantly aware that there was going to be more to do after being called out of a life in bondage, and symbolic of a life in bondage to sin. And so after they crossed the Red Sea, a series of predicaments occurred. for many, many years. And it brought to their attention the fact that they had an active role to play in this ongoing war against evil. And this battle was not going to end easily. It was going to resurface again and again. And so they were required, therefore, to become soldiers in order to obtain the promised land and to serve active duty in this fight against wickedness. And God would help them. Of course, God would help them, but he was not going to do everything for them. They had to make an effort. They had to show God that their intent was honorable, that they desired to sincerely obey him and to live a righteous life and to do the right thing no matter what the cost. And so they would have to take steps forward, and they would have to move in the direction of doing what is right. And so God would give them manna, but they were required to obey him, to keep the Sabbath day holy. They couldn't go out and gather manna on the Sabbath. God would give them water, but they were required to keep themselves spiritually clean. And God would help them in the many battles that they would fight against heathen people if they would have the character and if they would have the courage and not join themselves with the heathen. And we have many examples that come to us from ancient Israel of God helping them to win wars against wicked people. When Israel was faithful, they would win. And when they were unfaithful, they would lose. They did lose many battles because of this. And these are enduring principles that you and I have today that have been handed down through the ages to each of us within the pages of the Bible. As Paul said, those things happen to them and they are examples for us. And so we too, we must have courage, and we must have honor, and we must have commitment. As Mr. Quinn pointed out in the reading, and I think you'll see they're going to go hand in hand, these two messages today. We must have commitment in our fight against wickedness. Let's go to Ephesians 6. The nation of Israel fought a physical war against ungodly nations and tribes. But the war was not only physical. It was spiritual in nature because Satan inspires people to fight against God. He motivated the heathen and he motivates the ungodly today to deny the principles of the Bible and to worship other gods, to put things before him. And he moved the heathen tribes to fight against Israel coming out of the land of Egypt and as they strive to go into the promised land. But in like manner, Satan influences people of the world today to reject the ethics of God and to abhor true Christianity, just as those nations abhorred the nation of Israel. But that's not all. That's not all that Satan does. You see, the devil, he tries to influence God's people, to cause God's people to stumble just as he caused ancient Israel to stumble. And Paul spoke of this spiritual aspect of our war in chapter 6 and in verse 10 of Ephesians. He said, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might, and to put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Because we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly or high places," that is, spirit beings that came from heaven, were once majestic angelic beings. And this is a spiritual war, as he pointed out. But we know that it often plays out on a physical battlefield. And though the effects can be seen physically quite often, they're usually felt. And the battle that we fight is one that is on a spiritual plane. And there's conflicts internally quite often. But still, it can be very arduous and even exhausting. Because it seems that so much of us, especially at the end of the age, so much of us have so many things coming at us so quickly. There seems like there's so much to do and so much going on, all that needs taken care of, and all kinds of issues and strife rise up seemingly out of nowhere. But even though our battle, it is a spiritual one, it has a lot to do with physical elements as well. It truly does. Because the spiritual directly affects the physical in our regard. And so what we feel and what we think internally is always reflected externally in how we react, how we behave, what our attitudes may be. And even though our struggle may be within, for the most part, it is reflected without by what we do, our behavior, our actions, or our lack of action. These things can reveal where we stand in this fight, in this war that we're fighting, whether we're winning or whether we are losing the battle. And so here is an indicator as to how our fight against evil is going. Think about it. What are we doing? What are we doing, or what are we not doing, which we know we should? What works do we have that reflect our faith? Do we have works at all? What is our attitude? How do we treat one another? How do we speak to one another? Our behavior, our actions, or lack of action can reveal where we stand in this fight. How do we react when God reveals some of our shortcomings or faults to us? Do we lash out because it's coming from somebody that we are actually able to yell at? You know, sometimes we take things out on the people we love when we know, when we're just trying to deny the fact that the problem is really within ourselves. Do we try to put out of our mind, therefore, that which we know we should do in the hopes that we're going to be okay anyway? That we're still righteous and I'm going to be okay, even though I'm not going to work on overcoming certain sins. You know, if we do this, if we're going in that direction, this is a grave mistake. It's losing the fight. It really is. Because although God will fight for us, yes, He will fight for us. Do not think God is going to fight our battles with us if we lack the individual willpower to fight ourselves. And so we see then that half the battle, or perhaps even a majority of the battle, is found within our own minds. We struggle with such things, with feelings, with pride, with ego, with hurt. And though pools of the flesh, they stem from wavelengths that are broadcast by Satan, broadcasting lawlessness around the world, we must accept the fact that the enemy can be ourself, because we make the final decision. We really do it, whether or not we're going to give in to iniquity or not. And in this way, many of us, I think, are then found. If we would admit it, and it's frightening to think of, but it's true, many of us are actually found fraternizing with the enemy, with the devil, in fact. But there is a way out of this. There is a way to not allow ourselves to be the devil's associate, if you will, if you let me say it that way, and instead to be an ally with God. Let's go to Isaiah in chapter 59. Isaiah 59. To illustrate this point, I'd like to consider a real military conflict. After World War II, General Douglas MacArthur was set up as a type of viceroy over Japan. Now, because the Japanese were sorely defeated, there was no resistance to the American occupation at that time. Those American soldiers that were stationed in Japan found that their job in the territory was an easy one, and actually, I think it was quite enjoyable for a period of time. There was no conflicts. They could leisurely enjoy the Japanese food, drink sake, and date Japanese women. However, during this time, there was a formidable foe that was building in North Korea. And when the North Koreans attacked South Korea, the United Nations and the American forces were caught off guard, and frankly, they were rather soft. They had become soft. They could not hold the enemy back, and the North Koreans were making a lot of headway, even capturing the city of Seoul, Korea. Now, MacArthur came up with a plan, and it was codenamed Operation Chromite, which became known later after it was executed as the Battle of Inchon. To this day, military scholars consider the battle one of the most decisive military operations in modern warfare. And his plan was to do, therefore, the unexpected, an amphibious assault on the city of Incheon to cut off the supply and the communication line of the North Korean soldiers. Now, it sounds simple in words, but it really was not. It was much more complicated. It had to be precise, and it had to be executed without flaw. And so it began as 43 American warplanes napalmed the slope of Walmito that was near Incheon and made way for the assault. And the destroyers started heading into the island, or the channel there, and pummeled the city. Three beachheads were designated as for landing points, and they were quite successful in doing this. And then the supply and the communications of the North Korean soldiers was severed, and it left tens of thousands of North Korean soldiers without communication, without supplies, and they were scrambling for their lives in almost near confusion. This decisive maneuver is what the devil tries to do to us as Christian soldiers. He is trying to cut off our supply line, our communication line with God. And if he can cause us then to question certain doctrines, to question ethics, to misbehave occasionally, to let selfish desires motivate our behavior, this works to cut us off from God. Even if we don't think our communication is being severed, we might still be praying. But are our prayers being received? Let's look at this, Isaiah 59, in verse 1. The prophet said, "Behold, the Eternal's hand is not shortened, that it cannot save." Of course not. God can do anything. He is the Almighty, all-powerful. "Nor is his ear heavy, that it cannot hear." He can always hear. But, "your iniquities have separated you from your God, and your sins have hidden his face from you, so that he will not hear." He will not hear. So we can study, and we can pray till we're blue in the face, but if we are not doing what God asks us to do, doing what we should, if we do not have the works of faith that are required of a Christian soldier, or if we are not actively serving in active duty, so to speak, God's not listening. He's not listening. Not that he can't hear, but he's going to refuse to listen. And so we live, think about this. This was brought up in the reading as well. We live in a bountiful country today, and we have had it good for a long, long time. All of us have had it good. Most of us do not struggle in the way that much of the world does. And I was even speaking with my wife about her best friend has her husband serves in the Doctors Without Borders. And he's currently in, in Ethiopia, serving out there. Those people are struggling without shoes. And we get upset when our hamburger doesn't have cheese on it. In any case, I think because of this, because we have been had it so good for such a long time, we have become soft in many ways. And then when God allows us to be tested and Satan tries to infiltrate our mental ranks, if you will, it might not be too difficult because most of us haven't had it that hard. And so it's easy for us to become discomfited. 2 Timothy in chapter 2. Mr. Armstrong used to say that the church, members of the church, should try to live more modestly so that we won't be shocked, caught off guard, if you will, when times get hard, when trials come, and we actually have to suffer like many people already do in the world. And they're going to get hard. They are going to get hard for all of us. And it's happening to a very small degree right now, a very small degree, as people are finding it harder to find work and harder to make ends meet. But we still have air conditioning, we still have wine, we still have hamburgers and chocolate, and we still have motor vehicles to drive around. We can still go to the movies and take a dip in the pool from time to time. And so we still have it really good. But it's going to get very, very hard, and much of the comforts that we have become accustomed to in this country are not going to be available to us. And so we have to make ourselves ready so that we can tolerate such hardships. 2 Timothy 2, and beginning in verse 3, Paul encourages us, stating, "You therefore must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ. No one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier." And the point in this is that we can't allow our communication with God to be disrupted. We have to be able to endure hardships. And in able to be able to endure hardships, we have to keep those supply lines open. And how do we do that? Well, we have to fulfill our duty. Our duty as Christian soldiers, our duty as husbands, as wives, as children, as brethren, as Christians. This is pleasing to God. This is what He wants for us to do, and it allows Him to hear us and to work with us. Listen to our prayers and give us support when we need it. So when we pray to God, if we think that we're not being heard, well, it might be because God's refusing to hear. And why would He do that? Because we're refusing to follow orders. To follow orders. And this might not be allowing for Him to respond. And so if we're sinning by not performing our reasonable service, as the Scriptures say, it's hindering God's response to us, to our prayers. You know, there also has to take into account that there might be times when our facets of our character need to be polished up. God allows us to experience a little more hardship so that we become stronger. But this is key in our spiritual warfare as Christian soldiers, to maintain our communication, our supply line, if you will, with God. Not simply with prayer and study alone, but with our behavior, with our lifestyle, with the way we treat one another. Having a lifestyle that is in sync with Christ and that will always allow for God to have that communication line open with us, to where we're going to pray, we're going to ask, and He is going to respond in a way that is favorable. Let's go to Joshua 5. Consider another question. Who is the commander in chief of all true Christian soldiers? Well, I think we know the answer to that question, but you know, Satan is the one leading the forces of darkness. We know that. He is the general of demonic armies. And so we know that we shouldn't be listening to him. It's the enemy. So who is the one that we should be taking orders from? Well, the answer is found in Joshua, and I think it's rather interesting. After Joshua had been given authority by Moses, Joshua led Israel into the Promised Land, and before they fought their first battle at Jericho in the land of Canaan, Joshua had a surprise meeting with our commander and chief. And in verse 13, it came to pass when Joshua was by Jericho that he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And Joshua went to him and said to him, "Are you for us or for our adversaries?" And so the man said, or the person that appeared to him as a man said, "No, but as commander of the army of the Eternal, I have now come." And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped and said to him, "What does my Lord say to his servant?" And then the commander of the Eternal's army said to Joshua, "Take your sandal off your foot, for the place where you stand is holy." And Joshua did so. Now the divine being, I think it's pretty obvious, but we see the divine being that appeared to Joshua, this was Christ, the commander of the Eternal's army. And we can know that this was Christ because Joshua fell down to worship him, and the being didn't say, no, don't worship me, stand up. And we have examples of other places where people fell down to worship at the feet of angels, and they said, no, no, don't worship me. I'm not the one that deserves to be worshipped. Also, the commander told Joshua to take off his sandals because the ground was holy, and only God would say such a thing, just as he said to Moses. And so this makes it obvious that the one that's in charge of all Christian soldiers, and in fact in charge of God's angelic army, is Christ. And he's referred to in Hebrews in chapter 2 and verse 10 as the captain of our salvation. And so this means, the point is, this means when God talks, we shut up and listen. We don't try to make excuses. When he gives orders, we shouldn't try to talk back and to try to reason within ourselves why, well, I can't really, I really shouldn't, don't have to do what God says in this regard. This is different. I'm different. You know, my situation is special. And try to make up reasons why we cannot fulfill the objectives that are given to us. God is not making a request in his statutes. He's not giving us suggestions. He's not saying, well, you know, I'd appreciate it if you didn't steal, or I would like you all to stop lying. That might be a good thing. If you feel like honoring your parents, you know, I'm in agreement with that. That would be okay. He's not saying, if you want to keep the Sabbath holy or to come up to keep the feasts with, you know, like-minded brethren, that'd be nice. No, he isn't telling us to, you know, paying tithes, that's a good thing, but it's your call if you want to do so or not. No, he says not paying tithes is forsaking, as we read in the reading today, it's forsaking the house of God. And so he didn't tell the church to go out and preach the gospel if you want to. No, these are not suggestions. These are not take it or leave it requests. These are commands. They're coming to us from the commander and the chief of the universe. And so why is it then? Why is it, I wonder, why is it that so many of us take them lightly and that we think that we can decide for ourselves and we can reason our way out of keeping some of God's commands and statutes and judgments? You know, if we're Christian soldiers, if we truly are a soldier in the army of Christ here on earth, a representative of him, we have to listen to the captain of our salvation. Get used to it. Because we're inferior to God. We are. It is not within a man to judge rightly for himself. And so we have to listen to the one who can judge rightly. The one who created Adam and Eve. The one who spoke to Abraham, the one who gave the tablets of stone with the commandments written on them with his very finger to Moses. And this is the God that's the same today, yesterday, and forever. And so we have to follow these instructions. The commander of the army, our chief, our master, our rabbi, if you will. And those things that he gave to us, they're working orders. They're not past. They're still in motion. They're enduring commandments. So the reasonable service of God's people in the past, it's the same duty that you and I have today. And if we think that we can disobey the commands from the commander of the Lord's army, then we are insubordinate, rebellious. If we feel like we can comply, but only in part. I'm only going to do the ones that I'm comfortable with, but not fully commit to God. We're not a Christian soldier. No. And we can expect to suffer the consequences of somebody who would be likened to a traitor. Now, it might sound harsh. Some of the things I'm saying might sound harsh, but it is the reality of the situation. And if you're honest with yourself, you'll see that it is reality. We are either for God or we're against him. We can't be indifferent, lukewarm, on the fence. It's one way or the other. There's no middle ground here. And so I ask us to not put ourselves in that position. You know, when we're told to keep the commandments, keep them. When we're instructed to come up and keep the feast, keep the feast. when we have been educated about how to keep the Sabbath holy and the principles, the enduring principles of the Bible, what's so difficult? Just do it. I mean, how do we expect God to hear us? How do we expect God to give us more, to bless us more, give us more of His Spirit when we might have trouble and we are mismanaging what we have already? He's not going to give us more. He's going to say, work that out first, and then let's talk. Let's go to 2 Corinthians in chapter 10. These are just a few examples. There are many of them we could, you know, discuss or bring up. And many of us, I think, have wondered. And sincerely, though, I think many of us have sincerely desired to know, what do you want me to do, God? Let me know what you want me to do. And though the words are right in front of our face in the Scriptures, it seems that some people want to have God pave a yellow brick road, or they want Him to appear to them and speak to them face to face like God spoke to Moses. And so when we are shown, whether we are shown through the Scriptures or whether we are given advice by somebody that's in line with the Scriptures or have gotten counsel from a minister, how is it that we try to discount it as something that is just an opinion and we can just excuse it away as if it really doesn't apply? Why is it that we have an easy time saying, you know, I love God, I believe in God, I will commit myself to you, God, but then when that commitment means we have to do something that makes us uncomfortable or something that we really don't want to do, we balk? This is not what soldiers do. It is not what soldiers do. Soldiers take the challenge to heart, and they see it through no matter what the cost. Even though ours is a spiritual battle much of the time, it does take real, tangible efforts to win this war. 2 Corinthians 10, and beginning in verse 3, Paul pointed out, "For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war according to the flesh, for the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God, for the pulling down of strongholds." So we have the Spirit of God, yes, to help us, a helper. We are not alone in this fight. And with God, we are able to combat the wiles of the devil, and we can win. Yes, we can win. And we can do this if we really try and make a wholehearted effort. He continues in verse 5, "Casting down arguments and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ, and being ready to punish all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled." And so we have to be ready to put disobedience down, to put it out of our lives, punish it by putting it away. We cannot excuse ourselves as if our shortcomings are really no big deal and it's okay, God's merciful, He's going to be okay with this. We have to have the heart of a loyal servant, of a committed soldier, courageous, unbending, unyielding to anything that tries to deny the duty that is set before us by God. Every thought, as it says, every work, every behavior in line with obeying Christ, who is the commander of our army. This is what a loyal soldier does, and that is how a faithful servant thinks. He obeys his master and his commander and does not try to work his way around the instructions, try to skirt his responsibility. Let's go to Revelation 3. Revelation 3 for a very familiar set of verses, and ask ourselves, do we find ourselves motivated to march against wickedness, or are we content with ourselves, with what might be half-hearted efforts? Are we inspired to do as God commands, or saying, well, maybe next week, maybe next month, or maybe next year? Are we united in our steps with each other? to preach the gospel, to go forward, to work as a community of faith and do the things that we can to support preaching the gospel? Or would we rather do our own thing? Are we taking steps to build the character of God? Or just trying to make things easier and more comfortable for ourselves? Well, still thinking that, well, I'm okay. The latter describes the church at the end of the age. And in verse 14 of Revelation in chapter 3, Christ speaks to us in this age, in his church, to the angel of the church of the Laodiceans. A word, laos, meaning people, and decia, meaning judgment, a people who judge for themselves what is right, or a people fit for judgment, in other words. These things says the Amen, the faithful and true witness. So he says right off the bat, I am the standard, I am the commander, I am the faithful and true witness. Listen, I am the beginning of the creation of God, the firstborn among many brethren. Verse 15, I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. I could wish you were cold or hot. So then, because you are lukewarm, half-hearted, in other words, and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit or spew you out of my mouth. It is repulsive to God, being indifferent, on the fence. Because you say that I am rich, and I have become wealthy, and have needed nothing. People believing that they're rich and increased with knowledge, and that they have works that are righteous, but do not know that you are wretched, miserable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you, therefore, to buy from me gold refined in the fire, that you may become rich. Talking about fires of trial, and even for many, the fiery trial of the tribulation to come. That you may be clothed, that the shame of your nakedness may not be revealed, and anoint your eyes with eye salve that you might see. And then he says, as many as I love, I rebuke and chasten. He's not doing this because he likes it, because he wants to see people suffer. He's doing it because he loves them. He wants them to change. Therefore, be zealous and repent, he says. And this describes the majority of church members at the end of the age. And do not think that it's not me, that it's not us, that we're the good guys, we're the Philadelphians, because many people are out there doing that, and that automatically rules you out. Laodicea is everywhere. It is in our midst. It is. I think there's a part of Laodicea in every one of us. We all have it to some degree, and because that is the spirit of the end of the age. And we have to fight against that spirit. Fight against that which is holding us back from being a true Christian soldier. We still have a chance, brethren. We still have a chance. The fight is not over. And we still have the opportunity to overcome and to prove ourselves to God. And do not pass this opportunity up to make good. This might be the only one you get. We don't know. Let's go back to Ephesians 6. You know, the United States Marines are considered to be the world's premier fighting force. And that elite group of soldiers actually have a lot in common with Christian soldiers. Yes, they actually do. What makes them so special? Because other military branches of service have rigorous training programs, and they have weapons that are just as lethal that the Marines possess. But what puts U.S. Marines above the rest? Well, in their words, they said, the truth lies in the individual Marine. He or she did not join the Marines because roughly 40,000 try to join each year and fail. The United States Marine Corps Press writes this. Those who survive the crucible of Marine basic training have been sculpted in mind and body. They have become Marines. Once he has earned the title and entered the Brotherhood of Marines, a new warrior must draw upon the legacy of his corps. Therein is his strength. The character of these warriors is defined by three constant core values: honor, courage, and commitment. Honor, they write, honor requires each Marine to exemplify the ultimate standard in ethical and moral conduct. Honor is many things. Honor requires many things. A U.S. Marine must never lie, never cheat, never steal, but that is not enough. Much more is required. Each Marine must cling to an uncompromising code of personal integrity, accountable for his actions and holding others accountable for theirs. And honor mandates that a Marine never sully the reputation of his corps. Courage, they say. Simply stated, courage is honor in action and more. Courage is moral strength, the will to heed the inner voice of conscience, the will to do what is right, regardless of the conduct of others. It is mental discipline, an adherence to a higher standard. Courage means willingness to take a stand for what is right in spite of adverse consequences. This courage throughout the history of the Corps has sustained Marines during the chaos, perils, and hardships of combat. And then finally, commitment. They say total dedication to the Corps and country. Gung-ho Marine teamwork. All for one, one for all. By whatever name or cliche, commitment is a combination of one, selfless determination, and two, a relentless dedication to excellence. Marines never give up, never give in, and never willingly accept second best. Excellence is always the goal. And when their active duty is over, Marines remain Marines. They are reserve Marines, retired Marines, or Marine veterans. There is no such thing as an ex-Marine or former Marine. Once a Marine, always a Marine. Commitment never dies. Finally, they write the three core values, honor, courage, commitment. They make up the bedrock of the character of each individual Marine. They are the foundation of his core. These three values, handed down from generation to generation, have made the United States Marines the warrior elite. Now, can we see the similarities between Marines and Christian soldiers in this way? We have also made a commitment that is for life. It does not end. We are forever in active duty that should include things such as selfish determination and dedication to excellence. We are Christians no matter what, because commitment never dies. We too must have courage and the moral strength to do what is right, regardless of what people might say or regardless of the adverse consequences. And we too must be honorable, having the highest standard of personal integrity, because the quality of a Christian must be in the individual. And we also represent something bigger than just ourselves. We are called to represent Christ. Christians, we have his name, and we cannot dishonor his name. To encourage us, Paul wrote this in Ephesians 6, in verse 10. He said, "Finally, my brethren," we had read this already, but I'm going to read it and keep going. "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the eternal and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you might be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of darkness," that is, beings that are blinding people, putting them in darkness, blinding them to God's truth with a false gospel of lawlessness, "spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day. And having done all to stand, having done all to stand, everything you can to stand. Stand, therefore, having girded your waist with truth. Truth coming from the Word of God, the Bible, the pages of the Bible. Having put on the breastplate of righteousness. Righteousness, keeping God's commandments, which will allow God to protect you like a breastplate would. Having shod your feet with the preparation of the gospel of peace, walking in peace towards the kingdom. Above all, taking the shield of faith, with which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. A shield and faith, knowing that all things work for good to those who God calls and live his way of life, that keep his commandments. And take, verse 17, and take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. The helmet picturing guarding our minds, focusing on truth, keeping our minds spiritually clean. And the sword of the Word of truth for both offense and defense. And then finally, in verse 18, he said, praying always with all prayer and supplication in the Spirit, being watchful to this end with all perseverance and supplication for all the saints. So keep in contact with God. Keep that line of communication open with our chief so that we may receive his instruction, his inspiration, and also his protection. So to fight against the wiles of the devil, this war that Christian soldiers fight, it's not an easy one. It is not easy. And it has already been a difficult one for many of us. But if we claim to be Christians, then we are engaged in a real battle, a real fight. Whether we like it or not, we're in it. And if we are true Christians, then I ask us, let's act like ones. Let's maintain our honor, our integrity. Let's have the commitment it takes to see it through to the end, no matter what the cost, and have the courage to go forward. Onward, Christian soldiers.